Welcome to The Art of the Impossible, a podcast for the design and manufacturing industry that explores how you can leverage technology, processes, and people to make the impossible possible. I'm Asif Mogul, Senior Industry Manager at Autodesk, and each week I'll be joined by two experts from the design and manufacturing world to discuss their perspectives on the challenges our industry faces and share what they're doing to overcome them. From smart products, mass customization, digitization, supply chain resilience, and the convergence of once diverse industries, this podcast is for anyone that runs a design and manufacturing business who's interested in making things possible. You can subscribe by following us on Apple, Spotify, or via your favorite platform. Hi, welcome to the podcast. So today's topic is supply chains, a real hot potato of several that seem to be bouncing around the industry. Now, for as long as civilization has existed, we have thrived and survived on our ability to get access to stuff that we need further and further and further away from our homes, or more complex things to allow us to, you know, work and play in the way we've become used to. Now, it seems like supply chains have been ticking over almost invisibly in the background, just kind of getting us the things that we need to do our jobs and live our lives. But due to recent events, some would say that the fragility of our supply chain structure has been brought into sharp focus. And that's kind of made a lot of people think about how can they build greater resilience into their business. So today we're going to be debating the future of supply chains and what resilience looks like. And to help us have that conversation, I've got another two fantastic guests. And the first is Rachel Eade, MBE. Rachel spent more than 20 years working in the auto and transport manufacturing supply chain and is currently supply chain lead at the University of Birmingham's Center for Rail Research and Education. And joining her is Barry Leahy, MBE, Managing Director of Playdale Playgrounds, and an honorary teaching fellow in entrepreneurship, strategy, and innovation at Lancaster University Management School. So a big welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Asif.
Thank you.
Great. So why don't we just dive in? So Rachel, maybe I could start with you. Is we hear the term used a lot, the fragility of the supply chain, leading to this kind of focus on it. And in sort of your sort of view and opinion, what was it about the current setup, the way we'd set our supply chains up currently, that kind of made it so fragile in the face of something like COVID? Have you got any kind of thoughts on that?
I think if we look at and understand what a supply chain is made up of, that will help to understand that fragility. So a supply chain is made up of many different types of companies and suppliers, all supplying goods, products and services into a larger key product. That could be a piece of play equipment, or it could be a car or a train or a house. So let's put that into context. When we buy one of those key products, we are buying it from the OEM, the original equipment manufacturer, or its agents. But the reality is the door handles, the wheels, the bits inside that make the engine turn, the nuts and the bolts, come from a whole range of different suppliers, along with the services that support that, the design, the engineering, the oils, the filming, the recording, the communications, the print, the workwear, the sandwiches for the workers. Yeah, all those together make the supply chain.
And you know, that's a really interesting perspective you've just given. It's sort of like, I think a lot of people might think about supply chains as like literally the nuts and bolts. You know, I've got my Logitech mouse here. I'm buying it off Amazon. It's arriving like this afternoon. I think it's just physical products, but the services, the support of the people that are behind it, it's made me think what you said actually. And I'm just wondering how many people view it in that kind of bigger holistic point of view. I think maybe that's probably where one of our problems are coming from. Do you think people look at it in a too narrow way?
Yeah, I think lots of people, particularly in the transport manufacturing sector, think about the metal bits that go onto vehicles or the plastic bits. But a supply chain and its fragility, going back to your question, is about the whole community. And also, the lower down the supply chain we get, So the guy that makes the nuts or the bolts that hold the door panels together, that then hold the door onto the car, he is so far away from the car manufacturer, the brand, that he'll be supplying nuts and bolts to hundreds of people, maybe doesn't even know which vehicles or which houses or which products they're ending up on. And he won't know that until he loses those customers or they reduce their volumes. And I think that level of understanding and communication across that broader supply chain is what makes it fragile.
So the sort of not knowing where your widgets or your services ultimately end up, and then I guess therefore not being able to put strategies in place to insulate against that. So that level of the unknown.
And you don't have a direct relationship with the end user or the end customer, because you'll be supplying your component to somebody else who maybe coats it, finishes it, looking at your mouse, puts it inside, who then sends it somewhere else. The processes around your product or process end up out of your control.
I was just going to say, there must be some relationship, though, also, when it could talk about how fragile it is how specialist it is. You know, the more specialist it is, the greater propensity to be fragile because of, you know, there's going to be, in that chain, there's key individuals, if it's specialist, or there's key processes. You know, broader the process, or less specialist the process, or less competitive the process, less the chance of it being fragile. But saying all of that, there could be one key process in a very uncompetitive, unspecialized process that disappears, which then leaves you wide open. But
leaves a gap, yes. And there's lots of experiences there. And I think it's really hard to explain and define a supply chain, because for different sectors, they're different. But the concepts of fragility, I think there's the common theme that the complexity makes them fragile. And a little bit is that unknown,
be it
a specialism or something that's much more generic, it's still complex.
And I guess, Barry, maybe interested your view on this. If we sort of take Rachel's definition, this kind of actually very holistic and broad definition of supply chain, it's not just the widgets, and add to it the sort of specialist nature of some of the things that we do. We're hearing a lot in the news about many manufacturers' response to, you know, the shock that the pandemic has put on their businesses. There's a lot of groundswell about, let's bring everything back on shore. Now, whether that's back to the UK or back to North America, or, you know, globally, a lot of people are saying, let's reshore everything. But given the complexity of the supply chain that Rachel has just described and the specialist nature of some of the things that we need to get done, do you actually think that's a realistic option? Or do you think it's a blend of some stuff back on shore and leaving the specialist stuff to the people that are able to do it? What's your view on that, Barry?
I'll be honest, I have mixed views around it, because I think you've got to be careful what you wish for. It is probably my global perspective on, you know, we as the UK, to come out of any kind of global recession, we need to trade out of it, you know, and therefore we need people from other countries to buy something for their supply chain from ourselves. And if everyone creates this culture of, we'll reshore and we'll create everything at our own, you know, I sell the majority of my equipment outside of the UK. Well, if every country had a supply chain that they could make play equipment in their country, then that would kill my business, you know, overnight. However, I'm also very passionate of, well, you know, what has the UK got? So, you know, if we just took the UK as an example, you know, what do we truly own? You know, what are we truly great at? You know, as an island, we're a small island. You know, we've got the number one financial markets in the world still, just. And how much more of it are we number one? You know, I was talking to a business minister recently, and I asked the question about, you know, are we really, you know, are we going in the right direction around productivity manufacturing? And he said, you must remember we are still the ninth biggest in the world, you know, as a manufacturer. My reply was, well, yeah, when we had the Olympics, I'm sure we were targeting to come ninth in the medal table, weren't we? You know, it's, you know, but it's, you know, it's if we could bring all those specialist services in and we actually got smart. And I was actually speaking to someone else, which I thought made a very obvious point not so long ago. And they said, when the pandemic struck, you know, we're looking at what we didn't have, and we're going to have lots of jobless over the next couple of years. And why don't we start the industries that were importing stuff? You know, we know what we import into this country. So why wouldn't the government target funding to set up what is being imported into this country? You know, let's make it ourselves. So I've got really mixed passions around it, because I think we should be a global economy. And because there is specialisms, and to be competitive, you've got to go out there and find the best, and be it best quality or best price or both. But we also want to make the UK great. I think it's a knee-jerk reaction. I think it's made the media and the press, and people don't really understand what reshoring is, or, you know, we say it and think that's the right thing to say. And I don't know if it is.
I mean, it certainly is a soundbite, isn't it? Let's reshore everything. But I'm thinking about, again, taking Rachel's definition of supply chain, I'm thinking about some of the customers that I know who've got relationships with manufacturers overseas, who have both the capacity and the capability to get stuff done at a level of quality and cost that they, for whatever reason, they can't do onshore. And I just wonder, you know, if it's really that easy to throw that relationship away overnight and then find, how do I find another you know, manufacturer just 50 miles from me? I just think that there's going to be some challenges in doing that. I think that certain things, as you say, the non-specialized stuff, we could probably do a bit of it. But it just feels like it's a balance or a blend of the two that would probably be the more sustainable future-proof route moving forward. Yeah, kind of, Rachel, would you agree, or would you think it's different?
I think I'd agree with Barry's view that trade, we're an island in the UK, and trade is global and reciprocal. And a lot of, particularly in manufacturing engineering, we trade on designed and made in the UK and England and quality. And we can't make all and everything. And if we want to globally trade, I think there's that give and take. We will always need to buy some items from overseas, either because of volume, cost, capability, time. And similarly, we want other people to be buying from us. So there is some pitching. And I think, you know, not going political, but the government's current industrial strategy is trying to pick out those areas where we do have expertise. I'm going to bring another word in here, which I think is important for the discussion later, skills. We need to look at the skills that we have. In manufacturing and engineering, we consistently, for as long as I've been doing this, working in this arena, we've always talked about an engineering skill shortage. Circa between 35 to 50,000 people is always needed, has always been needed. And whether you're in automotive, nuclear, rail, aero, marine, we're all fishing in the same pool of engineers. So there's a big job. And when we compare ourselves to other countries and their skills levels and the amount of people they are bringing into the learning environment, there's a big job to be done there. And you may say, well, why are you talking about skills, Rachel? But that's about competitiveness and the ability in this fragile world to adapt and change, to become agile.
I think you've definitely got something there where you're going with it, though, because I think it's more than the engineers. It's leadership skills, it's management skills, because, you know, reshoring, with, you know, I think it's a knee jerk. It's resilience. You know, people should be saying, we're going to look at putting greater resilience into our supply chain. And maybe we've just got complacent over the last, you know, few years. We may plan for a global pandemic, in, you know, but I don't imagine the majority of people don't. You know, we've got Brexit coming up. You know, how many companies have robust risk registers in around their supply chain? You know, how many people review it monthly or even daily? You know, And that's what hopefully the lessons learned from COVID, from preparation for Brexit, is actually to put resilience in. And I think it's the skills, you know, it's the specialist procurement that we probably just don't have, or it's never been stressed before. So it's not being stressed, it's not tested. And if you're not stressing and testing something, you're not fit, are you? You're not match fit. And hopefully they're the lessons we've learned, and we're going to, you know, add resilience to our supply chains rather than we're going to reshore. You know, we're going to look for different solutions.
And I think I think resilience is, personally, it's a much better term, isn't it? And so, you know, Barry, I know you've created over 23,000 play areas in nearly 60 different countries. And so let's deep dive into that topic of resilience. What would resilience look like in your supply chain of the future, or your, if this was fantasy football league, the fantasy supply chain, what would resilience look like to you?
If we really strive into the future, my resilience would be I'd make everything out of dust on big printers there and then, and that would be great. But then I'd need a and then I need a supply of dust though, wouldn't I, or whatever. We're going to be looking as we grow. So we're very much we're still an SME. We're a UK-based manufacturer, and we're shipping goods all over the world, like you said, to nearly 60 countries now. You know, and that isn't the most efficient way of doing it, is it? Because I would be dividing it up, but I've got it's a tipping point volume until I can do that, you know. And so my resilience would be to almost segment or twin the manufacturing in different places around the world with different supply chains. So then if there was an issue in one of those countries, I could, you know, double the capacity in another factory in another region. Probably would be, you know, it would cause a lot of pain at that moment in time, but would give me resilience. At this moment in time, everything comes through one center. Well, three centers in the UK. But
so as an example, if you've got like a rotor molded product that's being supplied from, I don't know, to Germany, a strategy could be to build up a potential standby twin in Manchester or something like that. That you know, you could do the same sort of thing.
Or in Asia, yeah, that is supplying the Asian market.
Or in Asia, right? Okay.
That if the Asian market went down, or that factory went down for any reason, well, I turn on the German machine, you know. Which bigger industries have? They have the luxury of having. So, you know, I'm behind that, aren't I? You know, and that's where my resilience will grow, where I've got several suppliers around the globe supplying different markets. But I'm only replicating what the norm is now for big manufacturers.
And Rachel, from the conversations you must have with companies, you must see on a sliding scale of 1 to 10, 1 being not resilient, 10 being super resilient. What are some of those really resilient supply chains? What do they look like? What is it that they're doing that perhaps, you know, we could all learn from?
I think the companies that I'm talking with and working with, there's the whole range of factors, 1 to 10, included in that, and as there is in all life avenues. I think those that I would say are showing stronger resilience are those that have a mixture, and I've got a sort of a list of words and topics. Skills, which I think we've already discussed, and that isn't just shop floor skills, but does distinctly include the leadership and the management skills that tend to, in particularly small manufacturing companies, get forgotten or put to one side for later. I think something about culture, that a company, which comes out of the leadership, a company has a culture of team working, striving together, along with continuous improvement. Quite often, and when I go into companies and particularly factories, and you do the factory tour and you walk around, one of the cultural things I look for is, will the workers, whatever they're doing, look you in the eye and say hello? There are numbers where people don't. And I hate to say it, that gives me a view of culture. So leadership, I've mentioned. As Barry said, I think your supply chain and your localising, if appropriate, or your globalising as appropriate, but also the partnership basis of that supply chain, and therefore the communication that you invest with your supply chain and partners.
Can you be a bit more specific? What do you mean by the partnership between...
That if you are buying, let's just talk about components, but it could be anything, you are just not doing that on a transactional one-off basis. That's not a supply chain relationship. That is just a transactional purchase. If you want to be developing your product, your market, your penetration of that market, and hopefully upping your volumes, you need your suppliers, your partners, to be coming with you. So communicating with them about the sensitivity of price, the sensitivity of timing, the sensitivity of product and quality, the need to look at innovation and work with you on designing new versions, new products, using different materials. And a really good example of that is lighter weight materials, stronger materials, just different materials, you know, in terms of environmental. And it's very easy to see companies that are in a supply chain where they are being forced, bullied, rather than being involved in those conversations in a partnership way, in a development way, to get the best out of both sides of that partnership. So that's sort of the cultural. If we all work together, we will get a better result. And even in a transactional purchasing, procurement basis, those attributes still apply, rather than just Googling to find, I need 10 of those or 1,000 of those and buying them. That isn't a long-term sustainable partnership.
So have the right skills, have the right culture, and have the right relationship. And from that, it's sort of like try and embrace more of a strategic partnership with your suppliers, as opposed to you're just there for me to buy stuff off at, you know, 50p a unit kind of thing.
A couple of other ones I'd add onto that. That whatever you are doing within both your supply chain, your partnerships, but as a business, you're adding value. Now, that will depend on what your business is. But you have to be adding value, otherwise you don't have a business. A couple of other things that are really important for me is the one about diversification of your customer base. So you haven't got all your eggs in one basket. And I did a lot of work supporting the MG Rover supply chain when MG Rover closed unexpectedly. And in the Midlands, there was a high percentage of manufacturing companies that were over-dependent on that one customer. So that was a real shock to them. But that lesson continues to be reminded to people. Don't, just because this sounds wonderful and it's a large order, yes, take it, but don't let that be your only customer and your only order. Because when it stops or it fails or we have a pandemic, what else have you got? So diversification of customer. And the other one that backs all of that up, which is a huge topic in its own right, is access to finance. But if you can pull all those together with your strong leaders and management team, that I think that's a good base to be resilient.
What's great about listening to that description of resilience, we're actually defining lots today on this call, aren't we? So, is that we haven't mentioned technology once yet, which I'm really, really excited about, because it seems to be it's more about the people and the culture. And so, again, you know, we do hear about technology that's really important to the future of supply chains, and technology can automate our supply chain relationships. But I guess there's a balance of you could go too far down that route. And maybe technology might help us stay in the transactional world, and we're not really thinking about strategic partnership, because we just, for some reason, feel like, you know what, the tech will sort it out. I don't need to invest in the relationship of my partners. What have you seen examples where the tech's been taken too far and it's kind of like killed the relationship? But Barry, from your point of view, what's your view on that?
I don't think tech's been taken too far. I think we're not utilizing tech as much as we should, but you know, let's go back to basics in that we don't want to digitize or technify the wrong process. You know, the process has got to be right. So if you're going to, you know, I'm Rachel, I think it's all about the culture, you know, and it's a collaborative culture. And I think there's You know, and maybe that is one of the things around our productivity puzzle in the UK. Because of our supply chain relationship, we're very much, general comment, but we can be in the UK very much like, I'm the customer, therefore you will do for me, you know, this. Whereas if you've got this collaborative approach of how we're going to work together, you know, all right, we can have service level agreements if we measure OTIF, but I'm adamant, if you were to work closer together in collaboration with your key stakeholders, your key partners, as Rachel said, the partners, your suppliers, that you will be more productive. And then if in that collaborative relationship we've got the culture right and we all know which direction we're both pointing in the same direction, then we introduce the tech and we then make another quantum leap forward because, you know, we're digitizing the correct culture and process, and that's when we'll both find gains, you know, hopefully for the supplier. You know, it's about developing your supplier as well. You know, you're talking about skills. 18 months ago now, I put the MD of one of our suppliers through a year's university course on, you know, advanced manufacturing and getting more from people. Because if my supplier is performing better, therefore we will perform better. And everyone thought I was nuts, you know. Well, they're your supplier. What are you doing developing them for? You know, it's because it will help. It's just this collaboration. I just think we get it wrong at times. But
And it's that word comes up so often in even different conversations we had. We had a conversation on a podcast this morning about bringing education and industry together to kind of take a look at the skills gap, to your point, Rachel. And collaboration came out as, you know, it's not about the tech. It's not about, it's just about the people and our attitude. And that's what's really kind of heartening to me in terms of we have the power and control to fix this problem. We're not beholden to a wonderful piece of technology. It's all down to us as human beings. And that's great. But why is it so hard? Rachel, the kind of conversations you've had with people, why do people struggle with collaboration so much? It, you know, on the face of it, logically, it seems a no-brainer. But you know, when it comes down to the practicalities of it, we do tend to struggle, I think.
I think it's some of the key elements of relationship building and trust. And lots of small companies that maybe don't have more the experience of both business and leadership find that hard, and particularly if they've had a bad or a poor experience, that makes it even harder for them to trust people. And I even see MDs who don't necessarily trust their own management teams. If you're an owner managed business and it's your house, your kids, your car, your family, trust is a hard thing, not just to earn but to keep. It's a hard area. It's about communication. Along with, and I always, any MDs that I work with, I say, but you need not just to listen to what people are telling you, you have to invest the time to go away and research it so that you can validate and verify. If somebody's saying you the demand for this product is going to be 10,000 a year, is that just because they're trying to get you to gear up and they want you to reduce the price? Or is that genuine and is there potential? But it's beholden on you to go and do your own research. And there's lots of examples where those volumes and that forecast has just been an incentive. So it's a hard one. It takes time. It's based on experiences, your skills, your learning, your understanding. And also, interestingly, the use of technology, because that helps you explore. It helps you create some relationships that maybe you wouldn't have, you know, even if they're online ones. But I also think the pandemic has showed us, and we're all sitting doing Google all day, but the use of technology can add value into your business operations, but doesn't remove the need for people-to-people contact.
Do you mean technology like sort of Google Hangouts, Zoom, Teams, that kind of, you know, collaborative tech, or are you referring to a specific tech?
No, I'm talking about the collaborative tech, but also the whole Industry 4.0, the digitization in the manufacturing world as well, that requires more investment by companies and time to understand. It's not about automating everything. And I think there is still a fear that people think when we talk about digitalization or technology, that's going to automate everything and remove jobs.
Yeah.
The reality is it will enhance jobs, make the hard jobs easier to do, and upskill people, and therefore their potential to earn will be increased. But that has to be communicated and come in a trustful environment that we're not trying to remove people. It's a really hard, it's part of that cultural scenario. It's a hard one to describe.
It feels like, you know, we've got a lack of clarity of what supply chains really are. You know, it's not just a widget. A lack of clarity of what good looks like in terms of resilience. I mean, are there any benchmarks out there that, you know, if I'm a manufacturer, like a 250-person size company, I think I need to go and see what good looks like. Where are those examples that I could go and have a look at? I mean, do we have any? And if not, what on earth do we need to do to get them?
I think, I'm sure Barry will know different ones, but I think for every company in their local area, there will be examples of good. It will depend on your sector and what you're looking for good in, because a company may be good in its manufacturing process or its procurement process or its people process, but that doesn't make everything they do good. There's lots of ways you can access those. The easiest one is via trade associations, where you can meet other people. Quite often they'll open up their premises and, you know, what we call industrial tourism. So you can look, go see. And usually good companies are proud and want to do that because they want to share. But yeah, trade organisations, chambers of commerce, those sorts of people are, if you were looking for access to that sort of activity, is where I would recommend you go.
And Barry, how about you? So, you know, from what you've described, you're already doing some kind of like a very sort of forward-thinking sort of things. Where do you go to get kind of your inspiration of what good looks like and, you know, what might be possible for you?
Exactly what Rachel just said. It's industrial tourism. You know, I'm a big believer in, you know, you get out what you give. And is, for example, at Playdale, you know, we call ourselves tourist guides. You know, we should charge for the amount of tours we do around Playdale. But what that means, we get invited to other places as well. You know, we do it for a reason. We learn an awful lot from it. And it's this trying to break the barriers down of collaboration, because I don't believe there is a benchmark on what, you know, the good guide. I think the more you get out, the more you increase your knowledge. And you know, a good leader should have, you know, be able to actively listen and have a good set of eyes on them. And I must visit, you know, or spend time now on webinars or something like that. And I'll write one thing down from every hour that's invested, you know, and I'll get that back, you know, 100 times, hopefully, over the next few years. And it's time well invested. And I think if we are to get anything out of the crisis, or crises that are coming, you know, we've got the pandemic on the hot on the heels of that is, or mixed in the middle of it, is going to be Brexit, and we've got some momentum going of people actually asking for help. You know, then the numbers of people attending events online are greater, I believe, than what we were getting people to go, you know, to drive a few hours to go and look around a business. You know, it's made people hungry for answers. So let's not waste the crisis and keep that momentum going. And hopefully that will bring more collaboration, that will bring more benchmarking or competition, which then will, you know, people will increase their game and productivity will increase and competitivity will increase and we'll go on there. But, you know, we've made our biggest improvements at Playdale over the last 15 years is by networking, by getting out and going seeing what other people do without doubt, and then returning the favour as often as we can.
And that sort of brings me very nicely into the sort of the sort of last bit of the discussion I wanted to have with you both is, let's imagine the entire community of SME manufacturers in the UK is listening to us talk, or listening to the two of you talk, I should say. If there was one, two, or three, maximum three, practical bits of advice you could give them to start adding resilience in the way that we've described to their existing supply chains, what would they be? Rachel, let's start with you.
Okay, my top two would be, following on from the discussion we've just had around the networking, join your chamber or a trade association, or even if it's an academic organisation, seek one out, seek some references. Usually they'll let you go visit as a guest. There are a large number of those networking organisations that you can look at. Join. You have to invest time and effort, but you will, as Barry said, you will learn from them over a period of time that will help you implement and increase your strategic thinking. So take benefit of that networking before the industrial tourism, but that's the nice bit. The second key one, I think, is around skills and in particular young people. So manufacturing, we have an ageing workforce with many over 50. Young people currently, we all know, are going to struggle to identify careers and get jobs. But I think it's beholden upon any company, whatever the size, in terms of thinking about the future and young people and their skills, both for the community but also for the longevity of their business. And I think the other third one I would add in is innovation. Innovation for everybody is different. It could be looking at new customers, if that's new, so that's innovation for your company. It could be looking at your processes, updating them, adopting technology, that is innovation for that company. Or it could be being purely inventive and coming up with new products, new processes. So innovation in whatever way is appropriate for your company. So those would be my top three.
Fantastic. So network, invest the time to network and connect. Really think about skills and bringing young people into the organization, and then expand your view of innovation to products, processes, business models. It's not just, you know, a sort of laser focused view of it. So great sort of three tips there from you, Rachel. Barry, same question to you. What would be the advice, the practical advice you would give to any of your sort of peers or colleagues or customers who are maybe in a similar business to you?
Similar business or in a better position or a worse position, I'd say you've got to change. Because if you think you were up to date yesterday, you're already out of date today, right? So, and if you change slower than the world around you, you may be changing, but you're already going backwards. And that means your processes, you know, that you're doing. So you've got to get changing, you know, this continuous improvement culture. That is how you're going to build your resilience, because otherwise you're going to start going backwards. So change, and then it's don't bury your head and hope the problem's going to go away. Hit those problems head on. And that's usually around, like Rachel was saying, is building knowledge and investing time in training and developing individuals. And that will keep your culture current. And then my third one, which I went on about earlier, was, you know, get out there. You know, we talk about management by walking around. Well, management by going visiting. You know, let's pinch with pride. Let's not reinvent the wheel. Not, you know, that's not innovation, reinventing someone's always doing. Just let's go and borrow the idea. You know, and then we'll have more time to change bigger things.
So get comfortable with change and sort of build a culture of change in your company. Develop the people around you to don't try and solve the problems yourself and bury your head, but perhaps to invest in the people around you and develop a team that can solve those problems with you, and get out there and talk to as many people as possible. Network. Okay. So, wow, look, there we have it. So supply chains, clearly much more complex than just buying widgets off somebody from a different country. It seems to involve suppliers, the services, the support of those services. It sounds like it's much more of a community. Maybe that's our first thing that we need to think about. Perhaps if we start thinking of supply chains as a community, not a linear process, but more of a holistic community, and accept the fact that right now, a lot of people in the communities that we work with are unknown. So perhaps what we should be bringing to that is the right leadership skills, just business leadership skills, design and manufacturing skills, other skills, building the right culture, as we heard a lot about on this session today. Culture is so important that it just keeps coming to the top of almost every conversation we have. And investing time in turning your transactional relationship with unknown, unseen faces into more known relationships and strategic partnerships. So I hope that some of the things that we've discussed on this podcast today have inspired you to go out there and try some of the things that you've heard Rachel and Barry talk about and start adding some of that resilience into your business. So all I'd like to do now is give a big thanks to Rachel and Barry. So thank you very much both for being a guest on this really fascinating conversation today.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks very much. See you next time.